everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. This morning, we have the honor of sitting down for an extended conversation with Tom C. from Hawaii. I'm Ron. I'm in New Mexico. Dave, the other Recovery Cast host, is in Pennsylvania. And Tom is in Paradise, the big island of Hawaii, joining us at 5 a.m. his time. By way of a quick introduction, Tom was a Southern California surfer dude in the 60s and got clean in October of 1971 in Hawaii, where he still lives with his wife, Bee. We're recording this in October of 2015, so Tom is about to celebrate 44 years clean this month. You can read his story in the basic text under the title Mid-Pacific Serenity. We've got a lot of ground to cover with Tom, so let's get right into it. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Aloha.
Aloha. Nice to be with you. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Ron and Tom. Nice to meet you.
Good morning, Dave.
Now, Dave and Tom, before we jump in too much, this is you guys' first time you ever met, which is kind of interesting because you're both in that same class, kind of. Dave, why don't you tell Tom kind of your clean date, where you got clean?
Yeah, Tom, I got clean right here just outside of Philadelphia in January 19 of 1974. So I'm 41 years clean. And I've been to a number of worlds, and my guess is that we have sat very near each other at events, asked each other, but frankly, I never met you. And I only met the other Tom from Hawaii, who's often confused with you, just several weeks ago when Ron was visiting with me. But I've gotten to know a bit about you, and I've read your story, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say today.
Thank you. Right. Yeah, nice to meet you.
Okay, so let's talk, Tom, about what was the recovery environment like when you got clean? And we're going to talk about, you know, your specific story, but I mean, was there an NA in Hawaii in 1971, or when did that all come about?
Well, I went to my first meeting in 1968 on the North Shore, and we can get into that later, how that happened. From 1968 to 1971, I was staying clean and going to meetings, but I kept bouncing in and out. I just couldn't get it. Now, 1970, I was clean most of the year, and Tom M. was already clean. And so the military actually requested us to start having NA meetings at the military base in Kaneohe on the windward side of Oahu for all the Marines coming back from Vietnam and everything. They'd gotten strung out. So we actually had a meeting going of NA in 1970 on the Marine base. And there actually is still a guy named Al that is still clean after, you know, he got clean in 1971 too. So that was, but that meeting stopped. And then we actually start what is known as NA in Hawaii today. The oldest meeting is the Sunday night Ohana meeting, which we started in about February or so of 1973. So that's when officially Hawaii is looked at as starting the first NA meeting.
All right. So old timers who've been around a very long time, your first exposure was to AA. Was Flobird, who we'll talk about in some detail in a minute, was she an AA member?
She was, yes.
Okay. All right.
But it was, we'll get into that, but what's very funny is she was an AA member, and that's what we started going to on the North Shore, but it was after I met her first and then started telling my friends. So really what happened is all these addicts, you know, started following, going to the meetings because of Flobird. So we were the first group of addicts to start going to AA meetings in Honolulu in the very early 70s, late 60s. And we were welcomed. From my memory of it, it was very loving. No one got weird about us being there. And, you know, we were identifying ourselves as addict alcoholics. And I remember it as very inviting and secure and welcoming.
I read somewhere that some of the local AA groups took a group conscience because that group that you're talking about had all these addicts in there. And they wrote to the GSO to say, can we do something about this group that's, you know, not following the singleness of purpose or whatever? And the response back from the GSO was group autonomy. Each group,
right,
as to decide this.
And later, as the years went on, that was a few years after we started going that kind of stuff happened, actually. Okay. And that's actually how Narcotics Anonymous got started in Hawaii, that one of the AA members sent for literature, got everything, rented a meeting room at Fort DeRussy. That was the Sunday night Fort DeRussy meeting. That now is the Sunday night Ohana. And he took Tom and I over there and said, now this is for you guys. In a very, not out of anything of animosity or anything like that. He just did this for us. And we started meeting and he met there with us, you know, to get us started. And that was how NA actually got started, from an AA member getting the literature from you know, wherever you got it from then, from Jimmy, and rented a room for us and took us there. And that was it. That was the beginning. That was the first real meeting.
That's fascinating. That's almost a universal experience of, at least in the States, of the how NA, you look at NA communities back there. Someday I think we ought to do a story on the heroes of NA who were AA members. Some of those old timers, like even in Southern California, we're going to do a story on this, but a guy named Jack P was an AA member who wanted to get something going for addicts, and he involved Jimmy K in it. And that was in 1952.
Right.
So, and we have the absolute documentary evidence of it in the form of letters between Jack and Bill Wilson.
And we also have Ryan and Tom, we have Houston S down in Lexington, who on his own took a 12-step meeting into the Public Health Service hospital there for addicts, which ended up being called Addicts Anonymous.
Yes, which became the narcotics, which spawned, if at least, and the Narcotics Anonymous that took root in New York in the late 40s, early 50s. So a lot of interesting side stories there.
And I often tell people about this, and I used to have a tape from this meeting, but I think it was the Ninth World Convention in Atlanta, Georgia. Ninth World Convention, not just the convention, the World Convention. I think it was 78, and it must have been 78.
It was 79. It was 79.
Was it 79? Yeah, okay, yeah. It might have been 79 there. But anyway, I was the Friday night speaker, and even as late as that, I still identified myself as an addict alcoholic. The Saturday night speaker at that World Convention was totally an AA guy.
Yeah, he told a hell of a story, but he was it was a pure AA story.
Yeah, so we went through a lot, you know. I mean, it, like you said, so many of the older members found recovery in AA in those days, and then as NA transitioned in, we were going to both programs for a while.
Yeah. But I lost a job around that convention in 1979. A couple of my friends, I was a newcomer, and a couple of my friends were going to go to that convention, and they were going to hitchhike. I was driving the truck at that time. It was strictly against the policy of the company for me to have riders in my truck, but I was headed for where I could give them a ride about halfway to that convention, or not quite. And so I did, and we stopped at a restaurant, and guess who was having lunch at that restaurant? The owner of the company, that the trucking.
Oh, Jesus.
And they fired my ass.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, back to the
Tom, if I may, in another interview I heard you talk about a fellow you didn't identify there. His name was Roland, who had sought treatment with Carl Jung and had been put on his spiritual path.
Right.
All that is directly part of your lineage,
right?
To running into Flo Bird and all of your spiritual transformation around that. And I thought it was very gracious of you, because there is a tendency at times, some people have had bad experiences in AA, and they communicate this very clearly in NA, where they feel safe and loved. But there are many people who didn't have bad experiences, and
right.
I thought it was worthy of note that you mentioned that you mentioned the whole
thing. Well, you know, whenever I share at a convention, it's usually part of my introduction of who I am and why the 11th step is so important to me, just because of that meeting with Carl Jung, when he said, you know, he was honest enough to say, I can't help you, but in a few rare instances I have seen people go through a profound personality change brought on by a spiritual experience. I always like to mention that because that was really the birth of the 12 steps. That statement right there after we know what happened when we went back. And so that was kind of the birth of it when it was the first time anybody told us that being locked up is not going to do it. This chemical's not going to do it. It's going to have to be a profound personality change brought on by a spiritual experience. So I always start off my talks with that. I don't even mention AA, really. I just mention the way, what was the birth of the 12 steps.
Well, that story extends all the way to him coming back. And right. I remember a version of that story where he came back and they asked him to talk to, I think it was Ebby. They asked Ebby in his hometown because Ebby had run his car through the wall of somebody's house. And then Ebby's the guy, of course, who brought it to Bill Wilson.
Yeah, right. So it was just a chain reaction there, but that one little thing, yeah.
Okay, well, let's get to somebody named Flowbird because that is such an interesting story. So maybe we get there by you telling us kind of what your story in the end, your story toward the end of your using and sort of summarize that and then get into how you met Flowbird.
Right. Okay, well, in the 60s, all through the 60s, I lived on the north shore of Oahu. And at that time, and I was from L.A., California, so that's where, you know, all the love-ins were, the hippies and stuff like that. And I went, and I was on the North Shore also during the 60s. And what happened is that was the time all the gurus were coming to the West and everything like that. So if I wasn't shooting dope, you know, I went through like all of us, you know, I did this and then I was doing, if I wasn't shooting dope and I thought I was really doing good, if I was just taking LSD and smoking hash for spiritual reasons, you know, out there on the North Shore. And there was a big movement then. What we called the White Brotherhood in those days was a group of people that were with Timothy Leary and followers of Timothy Leary. They lived out there and they were supplying all the acid and everything like that. So it was a time of spiritual seeking, but not knowing. I knew that what I was doing was not working, but I didn't know what to do. You know, I just knew I wanted something better. I wanted what these gurus were talking about. And I've actually been, in 1966, I started meditating. I read this book, The Autobiography of a Yogi, and started receiving meditation literature in the mail, you know, these lessons. And I would sit down and literally shoot some nice methadrine, you know, and then sit down and try to study my lessons and meditate. And obviously that didn't work too good. But the thing is, I was really seeking. So I always say that 1966 is when I became a vegetarian. I still am. In 1966 is when I started meditating. I still am. And I just discovered about 3 or 4 weeks ago, because I always say, I've been doing this stuff for over 40 years, and I just discovered next year is 2016. It'll be 50 years since I've been a vegetarian and practicing some form of meditation. So wow. I was very much into this stuff. Now, and the reason I always talk about the 11 steps so much and write about it and all that is that it was so profound because it was the 60s and I was in the middle of it. And all of a sudden, one day, out of nowhere, there was just this kind of gossip going on in the neighborhood. Because right next door to me, I lived right in front of a surf spot called Rocky Point. And right next door to me, there was a 4-bedroom beach house that was completely furnished. And it was for sale or for rent. And the real estate guy would come out and show the house. And it was empty, but it was furnished. So one day, this lady just appeared out of nowhere and moved into that house. And the real estate guy came out the next day and he was showing the house and he said, "What are you doing here?" And she said, "God told me to come here. Can you please have the lights turned on?" You know, and so she was in that house for 6 months. But what happened literally the days before that is this lady at that time had 8 years in AA and she had had a very profound spiritual experience. I call it the 20th century Fox kind, you know, like, just like they described that Bill W. had in the hospital, where the universe turns to white light and all that. She had that happen to her. And then from that day on, she just knew what she was supposed to do, and that's help addicts and alcoholics. And she used to meditate 2 or 3 hours every morning, write in a journal, and follow that guidance. So on this particular morning, she was 40 miles from the North Shore at a house. And in meditation, it told her, go to the North Shore right now. And she was led right to this house next door to me and moved in. And she started a meeting within, you know, the next week. And that's how I found the program. So another thing about the 11th step, you see, I mean, so I really got it, you know, that because this is all she talked about was meditation and everything. I was already so involved in it. And right before I met Flowbird, I had already been doing the Yogananda lessons. And then I was one of the first people in Hawaii to get initiated in the TM in 1967. So like I said, meditation was just this huge thing in my life, but I didn't know I was an addict. I didn't know I had to stop the drugs. No one told me that, you know.
I've heard you joke about about how credible a coach for meditation you were back in the days when you were shooting speed and then telling people about how important it was that they get their spiritual life in order and meditate.
And get to be a vegetarian with a needle hanging out of my arm, yeah.
So she's living in this house next door. She's not paying rent. Did she ever end up paying?
Well, yeah, that all worked out. Some guy named Mike M that was in the AA fellowship in Honolulu, and he and other groups of people would come out to these meetings once a week that she started, the AA meetings. And he actually moved into that house. He was a school teacher at the time, and he started paying the rent. So Mike was one of Flowbird's little angels that would appear out of nowhere a lot and help out, you know. So no money was ever asked for. That was the thing. I saw Flowbird go around the world twice with not a cent to her name, just on guidance in her 11th step. And that's how we lived for many years, was just, I call it on the job training to learn to trust in the higher power. And we had like this on the job training where we really only had enough to provide for that moment usually, you know, and if it was time to travel, things would just happen. Hmm. And we would be gone, you know.
You used in your story in the basic text, you referred to the Beachcomber's spiritual progress tracker. And I wonder, did you refer to yourselves by that name at that time, or is this something later on that you...
No. That was the name of the meeting. That first meeting she started while living in that house is the beach. That was the first thing. And then it started traveling, so we added on traveling, you know. It didn't matter where we were.
That's a great name for a meeting, by the way. But it would show up in a meeting list if there was a meeting list at that time.
Right. No, it was never. We were never on a meeting list.
Right. I get you.
Yeah. It was just wherever we were, we would open our doors, open our tent, open the van, whatever. We just had meetings wherever we were led to.
And that, and you got there in 19, if I remember right, 1968, even though your clean date is in 1971.
Yeah, I was bouncing in and out for a while in those 3 years, yeah.
So how many people would have been in and out of this group, the Beachcomber Spiritual Progress Group?
Well, there was probably, you know, 7 to 10 people that were pretty much really there in the core of it, you know, and we wouldn't always be living in the same house together. See, there really weren't treatment centers that I know of in those days. And the 12 steps were very anonymous. Like when I went to that first meeting on the North Shore, I'd never heard of even AA, really. I guess I'd heard of it, but almost really not, you know, so it was very anonymous. So we were our own treatment center. And we were known as the birds because we were devotees of Flaubert, or at least I was definitely a devotee of Flaubert. You know, to me, it was a guru-disciple relationship. She would never say that, but that's how I looked at it. So it was always Flaubert and the bird, you know, wherever we went. And we there was a good core of us that were always traveling together.
Where had she found recovery, Tom? Flaubert?
In Southern California.
Yeah. And take us to the end of her life. Where did she end up her life?
Well, she actually, she started getting sick, and we sent her to, Tom and I raked up some money. This was about 78, I think 1978. She was getting sick really bad, and we gathered up some money. She was in Hawaii on the Big Island at this time, and Tom and I were both painters then, working, you know, whenever there was work. So we sent her to Texas to one of the people that was in our groups. In our group, his parents lived in Texas, and we had traveled across country so many numerous times, from Hawaii to Virginia Beach. That seemed to be one of our key spots besides Hawaii, was Virginia Beach. And so we had stopped at this house many times, and, you know, this guy's parents loved us and all like that. So we sent Flaubert there. She went to the doctor there, and, you know, they actually cut her open, and she was so riddled with cancer, because she was a smoker, that they just closed her back up. There was nothing she could do. So that was kind of the beginning of what we just call the end. And so a lot of us went to Texas to be with her. And I was there, stayed there with my kids even. I hitchhiked there from New Mexico. Because that's another place, Ron. Of course, you know, we had land in Grants, New Mexico, up above Grants. And so we had land there, and we had built our own cabins and everything. But Flaubert was dying, and she was always getting guidance to go places her whole life. And this last final time, she had guidance. She said, take me back to New Mexico. You know, so another guy, Larry and I, we headed out first in his Volkswagen van to New Mexico. And then Cherie and Marchand, Flaubert's daughter, started out after us. And they were a little slower because they had a bed in the back. They had to make lots of stops. She was, you know, really dying. And we got her to New Mexico. And Tom M. at that time, we all had these cabins we had built. And so he had an extension already started with a floor coming. He had a floor coming off the back of his house that he was going to put walls up and a roof on. And we got out of the car that day. Larry and I got to back to New Mexico early in the morning. And we put on our nail bags, and we had quite a community. And we just started building. We framed up. We put just this composite board on the outside that you put on before you did the siding. We put a roof on. We got this whole thing. Somehow a hospital bed got out there. We had and Flaubert pulled in around 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon and just waited in the car. We actually, at the end of the day, had a house for her, a room for her to be in with a hospital bed. It was quite cool, you know? And so that, what happened is the next day, she was in this room, and she was kind of going in and out of consciousness, you know, because she was dying, you know. And we didn't really know if she's going to live another 3 months, another 6 months, another week. It was just at that turning point. And that morning when I got up, I had this inner feeling I had to leave New Mexico that day to go to Hawaii. So that morning, I just knew I had to leave, and I knew if I left, I would never forgive myself for leaving her. But yet, here, the ironic thing is, this is what Flaubert taught us. All these years that I was with her, what she taught us is to meditate and follow your heart. Dare to step out into the unknown, no matter how silly the guidance is, follow your heart. You know, that's the 11th step. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. Praying only for knowledge of God's will for us. And that is the guidance we can get. So that day, we were just sitting in her room and stuff like that. And it was getting later in the day. And this guy, Larry, said, if I want, because I had to get to California so I could fly to Hawaii. He said, I'll take you there. if you want to go. And I was just so torn with going or staying. And everybody, Flaubert was falling asleep. And I don't talk, I've never talked about this too much at a convention, but she was out. She was like in a coma type thing, you know, and everybody kind of left her room. And I just sat in that room. Now, like we said, we added on to the house and there was a window that looked into this room because it used to look outside. And I was in the room with her by myself. And all of a sudden I just got up, walked out of the room. Everybody had gone. And it was about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. I still knew I had to leave that day. And I went and sat in a chair right outside that window. And I just started like close my eyes and felt what I felt like I was doing, but I wasn't doing this. I felt like I was just visualizing Flaubert in the bed, and I visualized her with a white light around her with a channel at the top of her head. And I just sat there and meditated on that. And all of a sudden I started getting goosebumps, the worst I've ever gotten. My hair was standing on end. It was just this vibration going through me. And I saw her astral body leaving out of the top of her head, just floating up in a white. It was really so unbelievable. I looked in the window and there was actually a mist in the room. And later I've read when a body leaves, that it can leave a mist. And I walked in the room immediately and she was gone. I mean, her body was laying there. She was gone. And I had actually witnessed her leaving the body with, you know, it was an unbelievable day. And so I went and told everybody and everybody gathered around, but it was a beautiful day in New Mexico. We know no cloudless days, you know, just blue skies. And within an hour after that, I knew it was time to go. So it was kind of weird that I woke up that morning and was told I had to leave, and I left. And my daughter remembers this and everything. Larry remembers it. As we left the land, we were about a mile or two in from the main highway. And as we were finding our way out our bumpy road to the highway, we looked back and there was an actual rainbow casting over our land on a clear day. And this is the honest truth. And because Flaubert used to always say, when I leave, just look at a rainbow. It's me.
Wow.
It was pretty heavy. I don't ever talk about that at a convention.
Yeah, some of those.
It's the honest truth. I've got so many stories, you know, that I've written about that are so unbelievable, like this, my experience with her. So
yeah, everything about her has that air of, man, how can you believe it? And yet here you are, you guys actually witnessed these things.
Yeah.
I had the experience one time of Tom M. coming to visit me here in New Mexico. And we said, let's go for a drive out and see that land that you guys have out there. So we drove out there and we went walking around, and he's, you know, it was just fun to watch him because he's, all these buildings are sort of now in a state of disrepair, kind of falling down. But at the same time, they're still there. It's like he's going like, holy shit, this is still here, you know. Yeah. He's looking around the buildings. And then he told me that Flaubert's ashes were actually spread at that location. So we went over and walked along the area where Flaubert's ashes had been spread, and we just spent quite a bit of time in silence there. It was a pretty powerful experience.
Yeah.
Okay. So speaking of Flaubert and this word guidance, she's somebody who always listens to, I guess, what some spiritual teachers call the still small voice.
Absolutely.
She's one who is really responsive to it. So with that as the background, let's talk about the day that, well, first of all, maybe a little bit about your relationship with Tom C. before. You're Tom C., right?
Yeah.
That other Tom. See, we were talking about it.
I'm telling you, we're always going to be mixed up.
I know. I'm sitting here looking at you and mixing you up. I love this. I love this word from Wikipedia: disambiguation. keeping it straight. Okay. But anyway, so a little bit about your relationship with Tom M. How you knew Tom M. prior to this day, and then maybe the day that about Tom coming to Hawaii and all of it.
Yeah, so Tom had an older, he's a few years younger than me. So back, you know, now I'm 71. I think he's 67 or 68 right now. So at this age, there's not any difference. But back then, I was about 16, and I was with, he has an older brother, and I was at their house in Malibu, and Richie and I were actually sitting around the table sniffing glue. You know, I was a high class addict, so we were sniffing glue, believe it or not. And in walks Tommy, who was his younger brother. So then he was probably 12 or 13 years old, which to us was much younger. And what I always say, he walked in and there we were sitting around the table sniffing glue, and Tom and I have been bonded ever since, you know. That was our bonding moment in life, right? And so he became a friend. And as the years went on, I was always coming to Hawaii. You know, this was about 1960 when we met. So we've actually known each other for like well over 50 years now, you know, over 50 years. And so I was always going to Hawaii, you know, and living there most of the time. So in 1967, when I met Flaubert in 68, so it was actually later in 1968. So Tommy had just gotten out of Atascadero, which is a mental institution for the criminally insane in California. And so he came over to my house, and he had just gotten a job driving some truck, you know, for a company. Shh, I'm doing an interview. My cat's meowing. So anyway, he came over to my house, and he knew I was always going to Hawaii. And he said, "I want to go to Hawaii, Tom." So and at this time, Tom can barely look at. I know. I'm telling you, Tom M's a miracle. You know what I mean? Like we all are. But I knew him when. So he can't even talk, and he stutters so bad. And so what we were doing, he wants to go to Hawaii. So we were sitting around smoking a joint, getting loaded, you know. And it was actually my I-12 step, Tom. This was a 12-step call I was paying on Tom M. But we were sitting there getting loaded as I was doing it. But I did tell him, you got to go to the North Shore when you go to Hawaii. And I told him that's the place to go. All the young people are out there. And I told him about this lady I met, Flaubert, being an alcoholic and all that. And I showed him a picture of her because she's very strange looking. She had really long grayish hair, like salt and pepper hair, down to her waist. And she was always in a bikini, and, you know, she was just a strange-looking bird, as we might say, you know. And so that the message he got, and he went to Hawaii, and the message he got was, in case things get tough, I can shack up with this alcoholic lady. That was the clear message I gave him. I did tell him about the 12 steps and staying clean, but, of course, we were getting loaded during it, you know. So he is thinking Hawaii's the kind of place he can ride his bicycle around when he lands. So he lands, and of course, Oahu's bigger than that, and the North Shore's, you know, a good 40 miles away, just on a country road in those days, no freeway, nothing, you know. And so he hitchhikes out to the North Shore that day, that night when he got in, and by the time he gets out there, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. And he just goes down to the beach at Sunset Beach. He actually went to Sunset Beach and went down. And in those days, it had a bunch of trees and bushes. You couldn't even see the beach hardly. But he goes down there and he goes to sleep. Now, he wakes up the next morning and he's looking around. He's going, oh, heck, what have I done? What, you know, I'm strung out. I hardly have any dope with me. What am I doing here? But something made him throw what he had into the ocean. You know, he felt hopeless, but he was going, what am I doing here? I've really made a mistake. Now, as we know, Flaubert always wakes up in the morning very early and meditates. And just, you know, we know how she was guided to the house that I lived right next door. That's how it all started. So this morning, so she's sitting there meditating, and all of a sudden, her guidance is, get to Sunset Beach right now. Urgent, urgent. And she just rushes around, gets the car started, drives down down the highway about a half a mile, gets out of the car, walks out to the beach, to the water, and puts her hands on her hips and goes, okay, God, here I am. What do you want? You know? And there's Tom waking up in the bushes going, what am I doing here? He looks up and sees this woman that I'd shown him a picture of. And he goes, oh my God. And he walks up to her and he can't talk. I mean, he just mumbles and stutters, but she hears my name and she goes, you're why I'm here. Put the stuff in the car, you know, put your stuff in the car. And he's never been loaded since. And that was December 17th, 1968. And he's never been loaded since, you know. And so this is why I, once again, I tell this story. Even when we just spoke together in Nebraska a few weeks ago, he said, you go first because you're going to tell my story how I got clean anyway. Because it's part of the way that whole thing with Carl Jung and this kind of stuff, the way it just sets the tone why the 11th step is so important, why the whole program to me is set. The first 10 steps get us ready for step 11. And step 11 is it for me. You know, it's where we find the connection with our higher power. And the 12th step is simply kind of like when the teacher used to have us write book reports on books we read. That's the book report of working the first 11th step, you know, the 11 steps to me. So that's how I, so that's why, I mean, my background is so with the Flowbird and the 60s and all this kind of stuff. I mean, there's so many more stories of how we went around the world and just were guided into these unbelievable situations. You know, it was just, it was amazing because I was with Flowbird from 1968 till 78 when she died, but from 71 to 78 when I was clean finally and did a lot of traveling with her. Like I said, I was the one single guy. Everybody else was in it. So it was amazing, you know, to be, live around this woman and see. And I always tell people at conventions, you know, this is how the 11th step works. We can all get that guidance, you know. And I'll tell you, most significant things in my life up to today have been, have happened because I sat and listened to the silence every morning, you know. Yeah. And I really think we can get, I think we can always end up in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, you know, I mean, having been around Tom M. and you, and listen to you guys, watch how, like I've watched how he lives up close and personal. He and I had some common service commitments together.
Right, I know.
Just really actually getting up every morning and writing in that journal, you know, pretty much in a conversations with God kind of way, and then spending some quiet time, and it just you know, we think that maybe Flowbird was absolutely somebody special and touched by a higher power or something in a way that we aren't, but maybe she was just absolutely audacious enough to tune everything else out and just go wherever it takes her.
Right. Yeah. We were all taught to meditate that way when in our group situations, whether we lived in tents on the beach, which we did, or if we lived in mansions right on the beach, which we did, or wherever we lived, everybody would get up in the morning and scatter to their own quiet spot, you know, and listen and write in a journal. And I might say, I believe Tom is coming up on, let's see if he got clean in 68. What's he coming up on? 47 years, I guess, I think.
Yes.
Remember? Yeah, he'll be 47 years. So he still writes in a journal, I'm pretty sure.
He does.
And I still meditate daily, but around – when I was about 20, at least 20 years ago, my journal writing, my meditation took a different turn, shall we say, into longer extensions of just sitting. And I don't write in a journal anymore. You know, I just, you know, that stopped for me about 20 years ago. But the practice of meditation has just expanded daily, you know, so.
I want to ask you, did you consider Flowbird a sponsor?
Yes, but also my spiritual teacher.
And in other words, this kind of roving group, the Beachcomber, I just love the name, Beachcomber Spiritual Progress Traveling Group. Did you consider it an kind of a traveling NA group?
Pardon me now?
Did you consider it a sort of traveling NA group?
Yeah. Yeah, we did. Or look at the Beachcombers was just, let's just call it a 12-step recovery group, because it attracted everyone. It attracted overeaters. It attracted everyone interested in a spiritual way of life, but with the 12 steps is what it offered us. You know, see what I mean? So, and then we always had it, even after a lot of us quit traveling and Flowbird was gone, we all actually had Beachcombers meetings in our homes. For many years, Tom had one. Other people that had met the bird and our whole group that weren't even core members started Beachcombers groups. You know what I mean? So it went on and on. In 2008, I started a meeting here at my house. And it's more what I call a Buddhist recovery meeting. It's where we practice, you know, we just do a 20-minute sit and then do a reading. But it's turned in. It has the same vibration, the same feeling, the same gut level feeling that the Beachcombers did. So it is a Beachcombers meeting I have here at my house the second and fourth Sundays. But it attracts all the 12-step fellowships. It's not a listed meeting. They never are listed on any meeting list, but we always hold them wherever we are. So,
interesting.
Now, you just used the term Buddhism, and I know that's. Would you consider yourself a Buddhist?
No.
Okay.
I'm very connected up with a lot of what we call Dharma teachers. The Dharma. Originally was just the teachings of Buddha, but the Dharma is just any spiritual teachings. The 12 steps are the Dharma of recovery. So, and somebody just wanted me to be on a summit panel of people in Buddhist recovery, but it was people that have left recovery behind and are just using the teachings of the Buddha. And I said, that's not for me. I said, I'm a recovery guy. Primarily, first in everything, I'm a recovery guy. And that's what I say. I'm a simple recovery guy. That's all I am. And do I use mindfulness as my technique of meditation? Yes. And mindfulness comes from that tradition, Theravada. Like Buddhism, I don't follow the religion of Buddhism. I follow the spiritual teachings of mindfulness, you know what I mean? And the Four Noble Truths. So I do not consider myself a Buddhist. No, I'm a simple recovery. I have a passion for meditation.
You use the term, I was going to ask you about this anyway, the Four Noble Truths. And have you given thought to their comparison to the 12 steps? Do you see similarities?
Oh, yeah. They're absolutely. That's why it's such a huge movement right now. It really is. So many recovery people are attracted to this because it's, and for one of the reasons is I don't get hung up on God. I don't mind using the word God. And most people that are, you know, doing the Dharma don't really, but a lot of people don't like that word God, as you know, from just being in the fellow. That's why we say in the beginning, power greater than ourselves. And I think NA has grown so much worldwide that we into so many Buddhist countries right now, even that we're not as Christian orientated as AA is. I don't think AA is so Christian orientated. I think it really turns off people that don't like that word God, is where NA is a little more casual. But that's why a lot of people are, because see, the Buddha didn't teach in the Four Noble Truths, which is the Eightfold Path. He did not come here to talk about God. He came here to relieve suffering of mankind. That's his mission. That was his guidance. If you want to talk about guidance, when he sat under the Bodhi tree until this thing happened, he got the guidance, you know, and he came here to relate to the suffering of mankind that everybody has. So, you know, it's not, so in that sense, it's not about God, but it is, you know, so I don't have any trouble with God at all.
It's interesting to me to hear you say these things that I was going to ask you about that too, but you've answered it. I've also thought about the three refuges of Buddhism being the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha.
Right.
And we certainly have that in NA too, the Buddha. The Buddha, you could say that in the broadest archetypal sense, the higher power, the still small voice, all of that. The Dharma, you've already mentioned, the Dharma of recovery. And the Sangha, I mean, the home group, the sponsors.
Yeah.
family, all these things that are, that, you know, primary community. So, and so, the more you step back from the kind of literal level of some, of religions, and get to that sort of whatever that deeper, more mystical level is, they seem to, you seem to be able to see that kind of parallel everywhere you go.
Exactly. And you know, the more we wake up, Ron, the more people wake up, they're not so scared to step out. You know, you call the NA purist, you know, that just, I mean, I'm not an NA purist, but it's the only program I go to, you know, but I mean, there's an awakening. Once the awakening starts, you start to see the love everywhere. You know, you start to see God everywhere. I mean, look at one of my favorite teachers, and I've read his book 10 times. It's so underlined, is, you know, The Naked Now by Richard Rohr, as you know how much I love that guy. And look at, that's right. I mean, here he is. What would you call him? He's just a Catholic priest?
He's a Franciscan priest, yeah.
Yeah, and here he is. If you're reading his book, it's like you're reading a book on Buddhism. You know, yeah, but
it's so. I was just thinking about him when you said that, too, because
God, I love that guy.
He talks a lot about the first half of life spirituality versus the second half of life spirituality, and maybe, and this is really true of recovery too, maybe early on the dogmatism and highly literal, like the NA purist kind of NA dogmatist kind of approach might help somebody to sort of have something concrete to hold on to.
Right.
Essentially to have a box to get out of when it comes time to get out of the box in the second half.
It's just like Thomas Merton and the Dalai Lama met at the end of Thomas Merton's life, and they really liked each other.
Yeah, they hit it off.
You know what I mean? They really. So it just shows being awake is being awake, no matter what the basis of is how you woke up. Once you wake up, you encompass it all. You know.
Well, there's an image I've actually heard Richard Rohr mention if you take a big wheel with spokes coming toward the hub at the center. If each one of those spokes is, let's say, a religious path or some cultural formation of an approach to seeking God, which forms as a religion, let's say. If you're out toward the edge where the wheel is, the spokes are kind of far apart. The important thing is the distinctions and the differences. As you get toward the center where the mystics are plumbing the depths,
right.
They all meet there.
I'm telling you. I love it. Yeah.
The same universal truths begin to manifest for the seeker.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's take a turn for a moment and talk about the basic text. And did you actually go to any of these meetings that they were having where they were writing the basic text?
No, because I lived in Hawaii.
Okay.
But what happened is when I spoke at that world convention in 79, okay, I met Bo then and other people on the East Coast. When I got back to Hawaii, it was maybe very soon after I got back from Hawaii, probably, they actually sent me a letter and said, would you send us your story?
Okay.
You know, for that, that's how I ended up getting in the basic text, I guess, as they asked me to, because I had just spoken at the World Convention, and whatever I had then, gosh, I only had about 8 years clean, but that was huge in the NA field in those days, you know what I mean?
So I've often said I've been an old timer in NA since I had about 2 years clean.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's how it is with us that are,
you're of that generation before me. You've never not been an old timer since the very earliest beginnings of NA.
Yeah.
Okay, so I didn't realize that they sent you a letter and asked you to you did. You know, so many of us at that time, like I was a young English major at the time, thinking I should write my story for the book. I'm sure I have something profound to say, and I had about 15 minutes clean, you know, but I never could quite get the discipline to sit down and write. So
right.
Okay. we were talking about guidance before and how Flaubert lived in such response to that guidance. And I would say you're also a person who does the very same, who learned that from her and lives like that, which comes out in your life quite a bit. And that has resulted in you traveling extensively and meeting some interesting people. I saw a picture of you on Facebook with Ram Dass one time, for example. And I know that you have had several encounters with Mother Teresa. But just talk a little bit about that, some of the traveling, some of the responsiveness to guidance and maybe some of the adventures that you've had in your travels.
Well, it started with my first trip to India to meet Mother Teresa. And what happened is I was actually in my meditation room just doing my morning practice. And all of a sudden, and like my guidance comes, we have tons of thoughts going on. I just don't try to attach to any of them. I just let them stream through. Meditation isn't about not thinking. It's about not attaching to the thinking. But anyway, I was just sitting there, and this thing about India came through, and I just ignored it, but it kept coming through, and there was kind of a vibration behind it, you know. I was kind of getting goosebumps, and all of a sudden, I was just sitting there, and all of a sudden, I wasn't getting the message, I guess, but in neon lights, it just came up, Calcutta. And I just rushed with all this energy, and I just knew I was supposed to go to Calcutta. And I came out of the room, and I told my wife, B, I said, I think I'm supposed to go to India. I'd never been there before. And I said, I think I'm supposed to go to India, and I'm supposed to go to Calcutta. And she goes, okay. I mean, she was kind of used to this stuff. And so I did. I went. And all I knew, I did know Mother Teresa. Okay, so this is back in the early days when World Service was sending people out. And I think Anthony went and with somebody else. And they had sent him to India. And they had gone to Bombay. And they had connected up with NA there. So I knew that. And they had already been there at that time. And then I guess they went to Calcutta, and the report, and apparently they were so freaked out by India itself, because it is freaky, that it was hard to even leave the hotel room. But anyway, their report was no NA in Calcutta. But I knew I was supposed to go to Calcutta, and I knew I was supposed to go work with the addicts, and I knew Mother Teresa was there, and da-da. And so I went. I just went by myself, paid my own way. Nobody, you know, I never got sent anywhere by WSO for anything. And there I was, and I landed at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The only thing I knew is that I wanted to meet Mother Teresa, so I somehow got down to where I took a cab to where the Mother Teresa missionary is. And I went in there, and she was around, but she was in a meeting somewhere. And this nun just, I said, I wanted to meet Mother Teresa, and I want to find the addicts, you know. So this nun took me on a little journey and took me to the House of Death and Dying, where they pick up people, and to the orphanage and all that. And I kept saying, where are the addicts? So at the end, she took me over to this lady's house right in the middle of Calcutta, and I walked in, and I met this lady, and it turned out her husband, they did have a treatment center for alcoholics and everything on the outskirts of Calcutta at this time. And so it turned out, I told this lady, I want to meet, that's why the nun took me there, because this lady was a friend of Mother Teresa's, and they knew her husband did something with alcoholics. It turns out I landed in one of the largest cities in the world, Calcutta, at 1 o'clock, and knew nothing, crowded as anything. If you've ever been to India, you know what India's like. And here it was 1 o'clock, I landed at the airport. It's now 5 o'clock, just 4 hours later. And right across the street from this house that I was dropped off at, there was an NA meeting starting in 1 hour.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's being led. I would say that's being led. I mean, if you could look at Calcutta and how I ever ended up an hour before a meeting that was, I was told, did not exist in Calcutta. And so I went to this meeting, Ron, and at that meeting, they had one white chip that they passed, and they had a white book. That was what they had, one white chip that they passed around as new people would come in, and then he would give it to the next person. And also at that meeting was, now I'm forgetting his name. He wrote a book called book was written about him, The Junkie Priest.
Father Egan.
Just happened to be in Calcutta too at that time, working with Mother Teresa on getting help for the addicts. So wow. I actually went to I met Father Egan. He said, meet us at this place tomorrow night. And, cause he was meeting with all the higher uppers in the Mother Teresa thing to how are we going to help the addicts. And so, I don't know. I just went to this meeting down these dark streets, and nobody uses headlights cause it's rude, you know, cause it shines here in other people's. So anyway, I was at this first meeting that they had about doing this. And I remember, I think my voice was, hey, NA, we can't be affiliated with Mother Teresa, you know, we can't do that. And I just remember that was my first trip there. I did not get to meet I had an appointment to meet Mother Teresa because I was leaving for Nepal after being in Calcutta for a while, and I was going to go to Nepal. And that morning I woke up so sick that, you know, I had beginnings of dysentery. I was supposed to be at the airport at like 1 o'clock. I went over to the Mother Teresa thing and I was late. I had an appointment to meet her that morning, but I was from being sick. I was late. I didn't get to meet her until
What year was that about?
Huh?
What year was that?
89.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, so I didn't meet her, and that, I won't go into how sick I got. It was very sick. And, I had a couple of NA members with me taking me to the airport, and I was just doing what I would do. They were asking me tons of questions like they do in India, because, you know, here's a guy with recovery and it's so new to them. And, you know, I was just so sick, and I was just 12-stepping. And what was really neat is this one guy that was with me, this one guy who had taken me to his house even during my stay there, and he lived in a 4x6 little shack with a bench, dirt floor and everything. He had a wife that was strung out and a baby. And I didn't know what to tell these guys. So all I told him is just what I would tell any addict. You got to get involved. You know, you got to go out and give away. This one guy had 8 months at the time. And I said, go to the treatment center, go talk to those people in there. Just do this no matter what, you know, no matter how, and it's not about getting a job. It's about getting clean and staying clean and carrying the message. Anyway, long story short, I met this guy many years later at the APF, and that when I was there in 2011 or 12, whenever we were in Calcutta, 2010. Anyway, and he's still clean. You know, it was a miracle. This guy, I hadn't talked to him in years, but wow. He was still clean from that ride to the airport, you know.
Well, that's incredible. You met him for the listeners who might not know, I'll say the APF is the Asia Pacific Forum, which is the forum that covers the geographically, it's got to be the biggest zonal forum out there. It covers all of Asia and Hawaii, Australia, New Zealand. And this entity that meets, what, every couple years? Or
yeah, every year right now. And they may change it to every couple of years. But and I was a delegate at that time, so there I was. So it was just so mind-blowing, you know. And I just got to tell this story because it's about guidance. So anyway, my wife and I, a few years later, we're going to go to India again. And in those days, you could just, this is way before 2011, early 90s, my second trip there. And I'm still wanting to meet Mother Teresa, of course. And my business was doing kind of bad at this time. But we had gone and made our reservations to go. And it was getting down to a point that we were supposed to leave in about 7 days. My business was doing really bad, so I was really confused. Do I just go off? We didn't have to buy our tickets yet up to the last minute, you know. And so I was at home here. This is a cool story. I love it. And I was at home here, and I went into my meditation room, and I said, you know what, I wasn't getting anything. Am I supposed to go to India or not? You know, I was asked to speak at a convention there in Calcutta, was one of the reasons we were going. But my business was doing bad. So I went in my meditation room and I closed the door and I said, okay, I need some guidance. Do you want me to go to India or not? I need a sign right now, you know? So anyway, I get teary with this stuff because it's so profound. So anyway, I'm just sitting in there. Nothing's happening again. Nothing's happening. I'm going, Jesus, why are you so silent? You know, I blow out the candles. I walk out. Ron and David, I close the meditation. This is the honest truth. I close the meditation door. As it clicks shut, the phone rang. I answer the phone. It's a Wood Valley Buddhist temple, which is about an hour from my house. About 8 months previous, we had made a donation there just on a fundraiser. And I had forgotten completely about this even existed. And it was Wood Valley. And they said, we just had a drawing.
Oh, my God.
And you guys won first place, a trip to India.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
I swear to God. You know, and we went to India, and what we did is we went to Mother Teresa's and we walked in to the Mother Teresa Center, and you know, there she was standing right there. You know what I mean? And I've met her many times because whenever I was in Calcutta, I would go to the early morning mass at 6 a.m. You know, every morning I'd go to mass because she would be there. And as humble, you know, she would just be in the back and the priest is, you know, the father is running the mass. But there's Mother Teresa right there. And I'd go up to her and just, you know, talk to her at the end of every, I mean, I went to mass every morning I was in Calcutta just to be in her presence, you know, just to be in her presence. It was just amazing, you know, it was so sweet, you know, but I love that one story about getting guidance like that.
Unbelievable.
Guidance comes if we're open.
Dave, you got any more? We're pushing past an hour here. You got any more ground you want to cover with Tom?
Well, just, you know, when you go back and look at your own story, Tom, I mean, I have to say, it really holds up beautifully, your story in the basic text. How do you feel about it? I mean, it's part of, so deeply embedded in the literature of our fellowship. How do you feel?
Yeah, I feel blessed to have lived the life I'm living, you know, and to have met Flaubert and to have been that direct. That's why I don't need to go. And that's why I'm still a simple recovery guy. I met my teacher, you know, and I meet lots of Dharma teachers. I hold retreats. I hold day long retreats right here at my house, you know, and have Dharma teachers come in and do the teachings. I don't need to be that, you know what I mean? And I feel blessed to have met somebody that has laid the foundation, you know. And one of my favorite spiritual principles now is hindsight. And maybe that's not listed in the book, and maybe, but it is a spiritual principle, because I've gone through like all of us have. Dave, I know you have. Ron, I know you have. And yet, I don't know what they were, but I know you've gone through many challenges in your 40 plus years of recovery. And I use hindsight today to go back to those when I'm in the middle of something. And I still go through, you know, I didn't get a gold star because I got clean. I don't get a gold star because I stay going to meetings and I'm in service and I sponsor people. I don't get a gold star for that. But what I get to stay clean through some of the most horrendous challenges sometimes, you know. And that's enough for me. That's everything. And I use hindsight today to look back at things I've been through that I thought were so horrible in the moment. But then with hindsight, I can look back and see where they led me. Mm-hmm. You know, so when I was diagnosed with cancer, that's what I did. The first hour or two, I was crying. Me got cancer. I can't have cancer. But then I remembered, wait a minute. Nothing bad has ever happened in my recovery. Nothing. Because I look back and I see where every so-called bad thing led me to a beautiful place in my own recovery, you know. So I feel very blessed to have met Flaubert, and I feel very blessed that people, you know, love Mid-Pacific Serenity. So many people come up to me when I speak and say, is that your story? You know, because they can, I don't say it's my story, you know, but they just hear that stuff that's written in there, and they just tell me it's their favorite story. I can't tell you how many people have told me it changed their whole recovery in a few words, you know what I mean?
No, there's a phrase in there that really struck me. You say, I only have what's in my heart to share. And I have to believe that's a particular challenge for somebody whose story isn't the basic text. And you get invited to these events, and there's certain accolades coming your way. that you might start thinking that you're supposed to sound a certain way and have a grasp on this thing and be able to communicate it.
I hope I never really do that.
What
I don't.
Right. What strikes me is that even back then when you wrote that, you state, I only have what's in my heart to share. And I have to tell you, that still comes through.
Yeah.
It's very vital and you're feeling it and living it. And it's not coming out of some knowledge framework.
Right. Thank you. Yeah.
That stuff you said about cancer and you've had serious health problems, serious accidents. You know, one of my favorite little moments was you were still pretty fresh off the prostate cancer, and when you spoke at a world convention and
In front of 10,000 people in San Diego.
Yeah, I think it was more than that. Let's say 10,000 conservatively, and you made the comment, you know, everything's working again pretty well. I don't think I could hang a towel on it anymore.
Yeah.
But
That was about, before I got surgery, this one guy told us, he said, if you get surgery and have your prostate removed, you're going to be incontinent and impotent, you know. And I just said, thanks for sharing, and went and left and found out about, So anyway, that's that story, yeah.
Well, your spirit just shines through, Tom, and I love you a lot. I really appreciate you, who you are. I wonder if you would say something directly to the newer member whose life isn't about world travel and doesn't feel at this point like huge guidance creating spectacular results and all that, but it's just sort of a real challenge to stay clean and to keep your head from, like I heard one guy say one time, my head wakes up a half an hour before me and then perches on the bedpost waiting to attack
me. Right.
What do you got to say to that guy, maybe as a winding up of this interview?
Well, to any of the anybody new out there that's going through a struggle, I know what that's like. Yes, I've had some magical stuff happen, but at the end of the day, it's still left. I'm here, and I've got to turn to a God. I got to turn to a power greater than myself. The end result, and you know what? That committee, they used to call that thing the committee back in the 70s and 80s, I think, that they used to say, you know, it's perched on the bedpost before I even wake up, it's telling me things, you know. And I call that a storyline right now, you know. I call that a storyline, and it happens to all of us. And what I do when that stuff starts happening in my head, you know, that tells me I'm not enough or tells me I'm out in the future about some challenge, I just try to take a moment. Look, I have a formal practice every morning of meditation. I never miss a morning, basically. But I have lots of informal practices during the day. And I would just say to somebody, when that stuff starts happening and when you feel defeated and your head's out there taking off and telling you you're not enough, just stop. Take a few breaths. Just be aware of your breath and just take a few. Just come back to the present moment. You know, that's where God is. That's what I found out. My God is in the present moment. When I'm out in the future, when I'm in a struggle, a challenge, I'm out there all by myself because God only lives in the moment. So get out of next week. Get out of next month. Get out of next year, you know. You know, and just get back to the present moment. That's all any of us have right now is right now, you know. And it's so important to be present in our lives. And so I must have to come back to the moment 10,000 times during the day, but isn't that great that I come back, that I'm aware of coming back to the moment, you know? I just say, keep showing up at the meetings, you know, you've earned the seat, just keep showing up. Don't be scared to share what's going on inside, no matter what it is. And that's how you ask for help. If you're not sharing where you're at, people aren't going to know.
All right. Well, that's the last word on that. And maybe the very last word should be the last words of your story in the basic text. Why don't you tell us what those are as put a cap on the end of this interview.
God is loving us now.